relaxed beneath her hands. "If he leaves the lump untreated," Ethan asked hopefully, "how long before he chokes on it?"
"Get out," Gamble snapped, "or you'll choke on my fist down your gullet."
After they left the private study, Ethan escorted Garrett down the hallway and pulled her into the space beneath the grand staircase. They stood in the shadows, where the unmoving air was cool and slightly stale. Ethan filled his gaze with her, so feminine and fine, with glimmers dancing across her dress and little crystal things sparkling in her hair. Despite her outward delicacy, there was something remarkably sturdy about her, an unyielding toughness he admired more than she would have believed. The life she'd chosen had come with the never-ending obligation to demonstrate what a woman was and was not, and what a woman could be. People would allow her no room for mistakes or ordinary human frailty. God knew she endured it all far better than Ethan would have. Thinking of the way she'd put Gamble in his place, he said, a touch sheepishly,
"The lump on Gamble's throat. I may have been responsible for that."
"How?"
"The other night, when I found out he'd been following me and reporting to Jenkin, I caught him in an alley and put a stranglehold on him."
Garrett made a few little clicking sounds of disapproval that he secretly enjoyed. "More violence?"
"He put you at risk," Ethan protested, "and betrayed me in the bargain."
"His actions needn't have turned you into a brute. There are choices other than retaliation." Although Ethan could have made an excellent argument in favour of brutish retaliation, he hung his head in a show of penitence and covertly assessed her reaction. "Nevertheless," Garrett said, "you didn't cause the lump on Mr. Gamble's throat. It's almost certainly a goiter." She leaned into the hallway to make certain no one was approaching, and turned back to him. "Did you leave any evidence behind in the study?"
"No, but they'll realize the safe is breached when they try to open it. I scrambled the combination to protect the account ledgers."
Garrett moved closer to him. "What about the information you took?" she whispered. The stolen pages inside his coat seemed to be burning their way through to his skin. Just as Nash Prescott had told him, the ledgers contained information beyond price. The secrets in his possession could end or save lives. At least a dozen people would have been willing to shoot him on the spot if they knew what he'd just done.
"I found proof that Jenkin, Tatham, and others in the Home Office have been conspiring with political radicals to commit bomb attacks against British citizens."
"What are you going to do now?"
Ethan had told her far too much already, and involved her to an extent that appalled him. But if he moved quickly to deliver the information into the right hands, it would prevent her from becoming a target.
"I'll bring the pages to Scotland Yard," he said. "The Commissioner will leap at the chance to be rid of Jenkin. Tomorrow, hell will break loose at Whitehall."
One of her hands came lightly to his coat lapel. "If all goes as it should, will you and I be free to—"
"No," Ethan interrupted gently. "I told you before. I'm not for the likes of you."
Seeing her bewildered expression, he floundered for a way to make her understand his limitations, the things she would want that he couldn't give. He would never be civilized enough for her.
"Garrett, I've never had the kind of life with dinner bells and mantel clocks and tea tables. I roam half the night and sleep half the next day. I live in a rented flat on Half Moon Street with an empty pantry and a bare wooden floor. The only decoration is a picture of a circus monkey wearing a top hat and riding a bicycle. It was left by the man who lived there last. I'm too used to being alone. I've seen some of the worst things people can do to each other, and I carry it with me all the time. I don't trust anyone. The things in my head, God help me if you knew."
Garrett was silent for a long moment, her gaze thoughtful. "I've also seen some of the worst things people can do to each other," she eventually said. "I dare say there's little left in this world that would shock me. I'm aware of what kind of life you've led, and I would hardly try to turn you into a tame man about the house.
I'm too set in my ways."
"At your age?" Her brows lifted. Ethan was simultaneously amused and offended by the way she spoke to him, as if he were some cocksure lad who considered himself more worldly wise than his experience merited.
"I'm 9 and 20, he said.
"There," she said,
as if that had proved something. You can't be such a hardened case as all that. It just nothing to do with it.
The conversation was a thin veneer over the real discussion taking place between them. Ethan felt his insides tighten with yearning and dread as he let himself think of what she might ask of him, what he might promise in a moment of insanity.
Garrett, he said brusquely, I'll never fit into a conventional life.
A curious smile edged her lips. Do you think my life is conventional?
Compared to mine.
She seemed to look inside him, taking his measure. Ethan stood there helplessly, more bound by those green eyes than by 40 fathoms of ship's chain. He was filled with regret for all the moments he would never have with her. God, his desire for her was intolerable. But there was an inescapable reckoning laid up for men like him. "Then I'm to have nothing of you?" she asked. "A few pressed violets in a book, and a new front door lock. That's all I'll have to remember you by."
"What would you like?" he asked readily. "Name it. I'll steal one of the crown jewels for you."
Garrett's eyes softened, and she reached up to stroke his cheek. "I'd rather have the monkey picture." Ethan looked at her in bewilderment, thinking he hadn't heard right. "I would like you to bring it to me after you've taken care of your other business," she said. "Please."
"When?"
"Tonight." Ethan was thunderstruck. She looked so innocent, as if she weren't proposing something that went against every social and moral principle.
"Akushla," he managed to say, "I can't spend the night with you. That right belongs to the man you'll marry."
Garrett levelled that direct, disarming stare at him. "My body is my own, to be shared or withheld as I choose." Standing on her toes, she pressed a soft kiss to his lips. Her slim hands framed the sides of his face, her thumbs on his taut jaw. "Show me what you can do," she whispered. "I think I might like to try a few of those 120 positions." Ethan was almost too aroused to stand upright. His head lowered until his forehead rested against hers. That was the only place he could touch her. If he let his hands take hold of her, he would lose control entirely. His voice was scratchy.
"They're not for virgins."
"Then show me how you make love to a virgin."
"Damn you, Garrett," he muttered.
There were things about her he didn't want to know. The curve of her naked back, the secret scents and textures of her skin, the intimate colours of her, the rush of her breath against his neck as he entered her, the quickening pleasure rhythms of their joined bodies. Knowing such things would turn the pain of leaving her into agony. It would turn living without her into something worse than death.
On the other hand, chances were he'd end up in a weighted sack in the Thames before the week was out.
Garrett stared up at him, her eyes bright with challenge. "My bedroom is on the second floor, to the right of the stairs. I'll keep a lamp burning." Her lips curved slightly. "I would leave the front door unlocked, but since it's you, there's no need." Chapter 14 Ethan went directly from the soiree to the upper-class Belgravia address belonging to Fred Felbrigg, the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. Taking the stolen evidence to Felbrigg was a logical choice, since he had both the authority and incentive to bring the Home Office conspirators to justice. When Tatton's and Jenkins's crimes were brought to light, a great deal of unpleasantness would ensue. Arrests, resignations, select committees, hearings, and trials. But if anyone could be trusted to do the right thing, it was Felbrigg, a devoutly religious man who prized order and routine. On top of that, the police commissioner despised Jenkin. It was no secret at Scotland Yard that Felbrigg was appalled by the spymaster's unauthorised position at the Home Office and the unsavoury intelligence-gathering methods of his hand-picked agents. Disgruntled at having to leave his bed in the middle of the night, Felbrigg came down to his study with a dressing robe thrown over his nightclothes. With his ginger whiskers, short, spindly build, and the flaccid nightcap with a tasselled end dangling over the back of his head, he looked like an elf. An irate elf.
"What's this?"
he asked, scowling down at the pages Ethan had set on the desk of his study.
"Proof of an operational link,"
between the Home Office and the Guildhall bombers, Ethan said quietly. As Bellbrig had sat there in shocked silence, Ethan proceeded to tell him about the Home Secretary's safe and the records of secret government funds diverted to known hostiles and radicals. "Here's an entry concerning the missing shipment of explosives from Le Havre," Ethan said, nudging one of the pages closer. "The dynamite has been supplied to a group of London-based Fenian activists. They were also given cash money and an order for admission to the visitors' gallery at the House of Commons." Pulling off his nightcap, Felbrigg blotted his perspiring face with it.
"Why would they want to visit Commons?"
"It's possible they were reconnoitering." At the Commissioner's blank look, Ethan added in a matter-of-fact tone, "for a potential attack on Westminster." It was no wonder, he thought privately, that Jenkin kept outmanoeuvring this man over and over again. To call him a plodder wouldn't have been entirely fair, but neither would it have been inaccurate. Felbrigg bent his head over the pages, reading slowly. Something nagged at Ethan as he watched the Commissioner pore over the evidence. He was certain Felbrigg would never look the other way if he had any inkling that Jenkin was conspiring to kill the innocent citizens he'd sworn to protect. Felbrigg hated Jenkin. He'd suffered more than his share of slights and insults from the man. Felbrigg had every reason, personal and professional, to use this information against him. Still, Ethan's instincts were jangling unpleasantly. Felbrigg was sweating, tense, nervous. And while that could easily be attributed to having been taken by surprise, his reaction didn't feel right. Ethan had expected some clear signs of outrage and perhaps a hint of triumph at being given the instrument of his enemy's downfall. But Felbrigg's white-faced quietness unnerved the hell out of him. The move had been made, however. There was no way to take it back. Something had been set in motion, and whatever it was, the only choice now was to keep to the shadows until Felbrigg had taken action.
"Where will you be tomorrow?"
Felbrigg asked.
"Out and about."
"How will we be able to communicate with you?"
"You have enough evidence for investigations and subpoenas," Ethan said, watching him closely. "I'll communicate with you when it's necessary."
"The account ledgers are still in Lord Tatham's safe."
"Still there," Ethan said, neglecting to mention that he'd changed the combination. He kept his eyes on Felbrigg, who found it difficult to hold a shared gaze for more than 1 or 2 seconds.
"What aren't you telling me, you bastard?"
"This matter will be handled properly and swiftly," Felbrigg said.
"I knew it would be. You're known as a man of honour. You swore before a justice at Westminster to execute the duties of your office faithfully, impartially, and honestly."
"And so I have,"
Felbrigg retorted, visibly annoyed.
"Now that we've ruined my night's rest, Ransom, I'll bid you good night, while I deal with the damned mess you've set before me."
Which made Ethan feel slightly better. He returned to his flat and changed into a working man's clothes. Cotton trousers, an open jacket, a work shirt, and short leather boots. Taking a moment to wander through the spare rooms, he wondered for the first time why he'd lived like a recluse for so long. Bare walls, hard furniture, when he could afford a fine home. But he'd chosen this place. His job required anonymity, isolation, with Jenkin as the hub of his existence. He'd chosen that too, for reasons he didn't understand and didn't want to examine. Stopping in front of the monkey engraving, Ethan stared at it closely. What would Garrett make of it? It was an illustration for an advertisement, with the product name cropped off. A grinning, top-hatted monkey, peddling circles in front of onlookers who kept their distance. Its eyes were melancholy or maniacal. Ethan couldn't quite decide. Was there a ringmaster just out of view who dressed him up and set him to his task? Was the monkey allowed to stop when he was tired? Why had Garrett asked him to bring this damned picture to her? She thought it would reveal something about him, which it didn't, by God. He resolved she would never set eyes on the thing. He'd be bloody embarrassed to show it to her. Why had he left it on the wall? Why had he even mentioned it to her? It would be better for both of them if he disappeared tonight for good. He could go to the other side of the world, change his name, become someone else. God knew it would increase his life expectancy. Garrett would achieve even greater renown, perhaps build a hospital, teach, inspire. She might marry and have children.
But for Ethan, she would live as a dream in the shadows of his memory. Certain words would always make him think of her. So would the sound of a police whistle, and the smell of violets, and the sight of green eyes, and a sky full of fireworks, and the taste of lemon ice. He started to reach for the picture, swore quietly, and jerked his hand back. If he went to her... God, the possibilities filled him with fearful wonder and hope, a deadly emotion for a man of his profession. What was one night worth? What would it cost each of them? Garrett came to the drowsy awareness of tender warmth brushing her face, like sun-warmed petals falling onto her skin. A soft breath rushed hotly over her cheek. Ethan. She smiled and stirred, experiencing the delight of waking in another's presence for the first time. He smelled like night air and mist. With a sleepy murmur, she nudged upward into the velvet caresses, catching at a firm, sweet mouth. Beneath the covers, her bare toes curled. "I didn't hear you," she whispered. She was a light sleeper and her floor creaked. How had he reached her so quietly? Ethan was leaning over her, his hand smoothing her hair. She had gathered the long, curling locks into a single bunch at the back of her neck and tied them with a ribbon. His heavy lashes lowered as he glanced down her body, clad in a simple white nightgown with little pleats at the bodice. Gently he settled his hand over her chest, the tip of his middle finger touching the hollow above her clavicle, where her heartbeat thrummed visibly. His gaze returned to her face.
"Garrett, doing this will make everything worse."
Pressing her mouth beneath his jaw, she drew in the delicious scent of him and rubbed a kiss into the texture of shaven beard. "Take off your clothes," she whispered. She felt his swallow ripple beneath her lips. He took an unsettled breath and stood. While Garrett sat up in the small bed to watch, Ethan undressed without haste. One by one, the garments were tossed into a careless heap. He had the most beautiful form Garrett had ever seen. Long-limbed and sleek, his shoulders and chest broad, his flesh toughened and polished to a hard sheen from years of brutal exertion. The light from a frosted glass lampshade caught multiple curves of muscle as he moved, silvered crescents gleaming over the powerful surface of his body. She had already known he was well endowed, but that wasn't the same as actually seeing him like this. Oh, he was something. Handsome all over, a potent male in his prime, completely comfortable in his nakedness. Whereas she, who was hardly ever disconcerted by nudity, felt nervous, embarrassed, shaky with desire. Before returning to the bed, Ethan's gaze swept over the personal objects on Garrett's dresser and vanity table. A mother-of-pearl brush and comb set, an embroidered lamp mat she'd made in school, the hairpin box with a crocheted cover, a long-ago gift from Miss Primrose, and a little porcelain jar of almond oil salve. He paused to look more closely at the small framed object on the wall, a pair of tiny knitted baby's mittens, each with a ribbon-work flower on the back. "My mother made them for me," Garrett said a bit sheepishly. "Perhaps it's silly to keep them on the wall, but I have very little to remember her by. She was very clever with her hands." Ethan came to sit on the bed. He took her hands and lifted them to his lips, kissing her fingers and palms.
"That's where you came by it, then."
Garrett leaned forward to press her cheek against the thick layers of his hair. "Did you bring the picture?" she asked.
"I set it by the door."
Resting her chin briefly on his shoulder, she saw a wrapped rectangular parcel leaning against the wall.
"May I see it?" "Later," Ethan said. "God knows what you'll make of it. The monkey looks homicidal."
"I'm sure he has good reason," she said, pulling back to look at him. "Bicycle seats can cause chafing and perineal numbness." For some reason, Ethan seemed to find the comment more amusing than it warranted. Laughter glimmered in his eyes, and the dimple appeared in his cheek. Garrett was unable to resist touching the tempting little hollow with her fingertip. She leaned forward to press her lips against it.
Every time I see this, I want to kiss it, she told him.
Kiss what?
Your dimple. Ethan looked genuinely perplexed.
I don't have a dimple.
Yes, you do. It shows when you smile. Has no one ever mentioned it?
No.
Haven't you seen it in the mirror? The outside corners of his eyes crinkled.
I don't usually smile in the mirror.
His hand curled around the back of her neck, and he possessed her mouth with a warm, hungering pressure. She opened to the silky intrusion of his tongue, the exquisite taste of him making her head swim. He eased her back onto the bed, kissing her lazily, filling her senses with slow fire. Gentle hands moved over the nightgown, learning the shape of her body through the thin muslin. Tentatively, she touched the light mat of hair on his chest, the curls soft and crisp against her fingertips. She reached around him, and her eyes flew open as she felt how deeply developed and distinct the muscles of his back were. Good heavens! Ethan lifted his head and gave her a questioning look. Your trapezius and deltoids are remarkable, she said dreamily, her hands wandering over him, and your latissimus dorsi are so perfectly defined. A low laugh broke from him as he unfastened her nightgown.
He'll embarrass me with all these flurry compliments.
His weight settled partially over her, his thigh nudging hers apart, and she felt his lips on her chest, skimming softly over newly revealed skin. Her breathing deepened, her pulse rushing, while his hands wandered everywhere, tugging at her nightgown, slipping under it. Soon she was naked, with all the textures of him, roughness, smoothness, hardness, silk, covering her gently. He was utterly in control, guiding her into a realm where he was the master and she was the novice. His strong hands moved over her slim body with gossamer light strokes.
I've dreamed of this for so long, he whispered. The first time we met, part of my brain said, I want that one.
Garrett smiled against the furry surface of his chest. She nuzzled against the neat, dark circle of a male nipple and touched her tongue to it. Why didn't you pursue me then?
I knew you were too fine for me.
No, she protested softly. I'm not a high-born lady, I'm a commoner.
There's nothing common about you.
Ethan began to play with her long hair, sifting his fingers through it, lifting a lock to brush the ends against his lip and cheeks.
Do you want to know why I gave you violets? They're beautiful and small, but tough enough to grow in the cracks of city pavement. More than once, I've been in some dark place and seen them clustered near a broken stoop, or at the base of a brick wall, bright as jewels. Even without sunlight or good soil, they show up to do a flower's job.
He bent to press his lips against the gilded curve of her breast, as if he could taste the light on her skin.
There was no need to leave a lamp burning in your room, he whispered. I could find you anywhere, in daylight or darkness.
Slowly, he kissed and licked a trail of heat between her breasts, leaving faint traces of wetness that cooled in the wake of his breath. He delved into her navel and blew gently into the small hollow, and paused as an unexpected scent caught his attention.
Lemon, he murmured,
hunting for the source of the fragrance. It's a sponge, Garrett said cautiously, a wash of colour spreading over her throat and face. One of the ways to guard against pregnancy was to insert a piece of soft sponge dampened with lemon juice. It goes inside.
Yes, I know,
Ethan murmured, nuzzling lower on her stomach. You do? A smile curved against her skin.
I'm no fledgling lad.
Gently his hand parted her thighs, his fingertips sliding down the insides to her knees and back up again. Down, up. The stroking was hypnotic, undulating, as if she were being teased by delicate tentacles. His mouth ventured along the crease of her leg and groin, an electrifying hint of bristle rasping along the tenderness as he nudged deeper, lower. Slowly his fingers slid into the protective curls that covered her sex, kneading and stroking, his thumbs parting the soft furrow. He pushed his tongue in and upward, separating the folds with a long, sinuous lick. Garrett stiffened and gasped, pushing at his head. Ethan propped himself on his elbows, a gleam of tenderly mocking amusement in his eyes.
"Have I shocked you, love?"
Garrett found it hard to think. Her entire body was throbbing.
"A little," she said unsteadily. "It is my first time."
"But you sounded so adventurous earlier, with all your talk of positions."
His fingers began to toy with her indecently, sifting among the feathery curls. Desire seemed to radiate from her. She was surprised not to see wisps of steam rising from her skin.
I expected we'd start in a more civilized way and work up to more adventurous things later.
One corner of his mouth quirked lazily.
"You didn't invite me to your bed expecting a civilized lover."
His thumb stroked into the tender slit of her sex and circled through a slick of wetness, a shiver of pleasure centered in the depths of her body. He shot her a glance of concentrated blue heat across the blushing surface of her skin, seeming to read her thoughts as if they'd been emblazoned in the air.
"You wanted to find out how much I could make you feel. You wanted to know what it was like to lose yourself in passion and find yourself safe in my arms afterward. Now I'm here, and I'm going to love you with everything I have in me."
His fingers gently parted her, teasing their way among silky pleats and petals. Mesmerized, she watched his head lowering, the powerful shoulders flexing. He began to feast on her slowly, and it felt so good she thought she might faint. His tongue coaxed and tormented, darting and swirling. Her flesh became wetter, silkier, the inner lips turning full and hot, intimate muscles clamping helplessly on emptiness. He searched the intricate secrets of her sex, growling softly in satisfaction at the private taste of her.
"Please, please, please," she wanted to beg, but the only sound she could make was a quiet whimper.
The desire he aroused left no room for dignity. Nothing could have drawn her attention away from him and what he was doing to her. An entire marching band could have come blaring through the room, and she wouldn't have noticed. She had become a purely physical being, writhing mindlessly until Ethan's arm slid beneath her thighs and curled around them, holding her snug and still. His attention centered on the peak of her clitoris, drawing it out, flicking delicately. Desperately, she reached down to grip his upper arms, the bulges of muscle so hard that her fingertips couldn't make the slightest dent. His tongue began a new rhythm, crossing over the sensitive bud in fluid, steady stroking, like fingers turning the pages of a book. Intense feeling coursed through every part of her, making her hips jerk helplessly in his cradling grip. The agile tongue never faltered, urging her into a dizzying rise of sensation. She arched at the summit, her breath stopping, her heart laboring too hard to distinguish the spaces between the beats. Pleasure came in a series of hard shudders again, again, until what tension remained broke into fine-spun shivers. His mouth soothed her for a measureless interval, easing her into peacefulness, until she was as limp as an empty glove. Eventually he moved up beside her and gathered her in his arms. She made a frazzled little sound against his shoulder, drawing a chuckle from him.
"You like that," he said with masculine satisfaction.
Garrett nodded dreamily. Gently Ethan reached down to bring her hips against his as they lay sideways.
"You'll need to stay relaxed," he whispered, "to take me inside."
She felt his shaft against her belly, heavy and stiff, searing hot. The evidence of his desire excited her, reawakening the need to be possessed, filled, taken. She slid her arm around his shoulder and tried to roll to her back with him, but he kept them on their sides and drew her top leg over his hip. Leaning over her, he kissed the side of her neck and closed his teeth lightly against a sensitive place.
His hands slid over her body, fondling and stroking. She was pressed against the solid strength of him, her breasts teased by the silky coarse hairs on his chest. He reached between them, adjusting the angle of his erect length, rubbing the broad, hard head of it against the vulnerable cove between her thighs. She tensed in readiness. But he didn't push, only maintained a gentle, constant pressure, a heated presence there at the entrance of her body. His mouth teased and sucked at hers, invading playfully. Cupping her breast with his hand, he rotated his palm gently over the stiff tip before taking it between his fingers. She couldn't help squirming at the wickedly experienced caresses, the undulation of her hips working against the head of his shaft. The opening of her body smarted and stretched. The intrusion felt impossibly wide. Daunted, she tried to hold still, but his beguiling hand slid down, fingers dancing over the folds of her sex, spreading and teasing her. Hunger knotted deep in her belly, and she was overcome by the impulse to press herself into those erotic, tickling caresses. He was mercifully slow, letting her accept him at her own pace. "Oh, this fingers felt so good." "Breathe," he whispered. She gasped, stretched, ached, quivered on his shaft. He helped her with gentle pushes, inching gradually in a slow, patient possession. Leisurely minutes passed, while his wet fingertips stroked, kneaded, and circled, until, unbelievably, the pleasure crested again. This time she was filled so tightly that her muscles could barely clench around him. When the last ripples of release had faded, he changed their position, lifting her easily, sitting up and letting her slide down until she was in his lap with her legs wrapped around his waist. His hands cupped beneath her bottom, carefully controlling the depth of his penetration to keep from hurting her. Bewildered, she sat with her arms around his neck. His eyes were dark and slightly glazed as they stared into hers.
"Being inside you like this, I wouldn't have thought I could feel so much without dying of it."
She leaned her forehead against his, their breaths mingling in unsteady surges.
"Tell me what to do. Don't move. Stay like this. Feel how much I want you."
He panted and trembled, his deeply muscled thighs flexing beneath her. The small motion sent a rain of sparks across her vision. He adjusted the angle of her hips until she felt him pressing against something deep and sensitive inside her, nudging in a steady rhythm. She brought her lips to his, and he rewarded her with a rough, ardent kiss. Devouring her soft moans, he kept up the ceaseless rocking of his hips, while her insides quivered over the stiff length of him. His body was so powerful beneath her, all around her, he could crush her so easily, but his hold was careful and cradling, as if she was something exquisite he was afraid of breaking. Lowering her mouth to his shoulder, she savored the taste of salt and maleness. He was very deep now. Her body had relaxed enough to take more. She rode the upward nudging of his hips, and everything was soreness and delight and wonder. The heavy muscles of his back twitched with pleasure as her fingers scored lightly over the surface, leaving invisible markings of ownership. His breath stopped as release caught up to him at last, the rhythm breaking. Blindly he nuzzled at her throat and made a quiet sound like a lost, wild creature. She curled her arms around his head, rubbing her mouth into the satiny locks of his hair, while her body contained the shocks of his release, the liquid heat, the slow, unfolding relief. They lay in a tangle, drowsing and caressing, as the night gradually thinned into a sharp white dawn. At the first hint of approaching daybreak, Ethan stretched and sat up, lowering his feet to the floor. Garrett rose to her knees and hugged him from behind, her breasts flattening against his back. "Don't leave," she longed to beg, but instead said quietly, "Come to me as soon as you're able." Ethan was silent for a long moment.
"I'll try, Akushna.
If things don't go as they should, if she should have to go away somewhere. Promise you'll take me with you. Ethan turned to face her then.
Love.
He shook his head slightly.
I wouldn't do that to you. Your family and friends, your patients, your practice, everything is here. It would ruin your life to leave all that.
It would ruin my life, not to have you. As soon as the words left her lips, Garrett realized it was the truth. I could be a doctor anywhere. I have a little nest egg set aside. Once we settle somewhere, I'll be able to earn enough to provide for us until you find a suitable occupation. We'll manage. I'm afraid we would have to take my father with us, but...
Garrett.
A rapid succession of emotions crossed Ethan's face, an odd smile twisting his lips. Taking her head in his hands, he imprinted a brief, hard kiss on her mouth.
You wouldn't have to support me. I have enough to... Well, it doesn't matter. It won't come to that.
He pulled her head against his chest and rocked her slightly, crushing a kiss against her hair.
I'll come to you if I'm able. I swear it.
Closing her eyes in relief, Garrett slid her arms around him. The next evening, Ethan walked along the footway of Blackfriars Bridge, a structure that was cinched across the lowest banks of the Thames like a buckled luggage strap. 5 wrought iron spans, set on enormous red granite river piers, supported the bridge's steep gradient. No matter which direction vehicles or pedestrians came from, it was a long, dead pull to get to the other side. Although the light was fading, the air was still thick with the growls and hisses of factories, the commotion of dockyards, and the bone-jarring clamour of a nearby railway bridge. Ethan passed a series of pulpit-shaped niches filled by sleeping vagrants, covered with tattered newspapers. None of them stirred or made a sound as he walked by. Finding a place to stand at the railing, he proceeded to eat the dinner he'd bought at a fish shop on the Southwark side. For a penny, a customer could have a meal as fine as any wealthy toff in London, a fillet of fresh haddock or cod dredged in breadcrumbs and fried over a coal fire in an iron cauldron of boiling fat. When the inside was firm and white, and the outside crust a sizzling deep brown, the fillet was wrapped in parchment, along with a hot lemon wedge and a few sprigs of parsley fried into salted green crisps. Leaning against the curved railing, Ethan ate slowly and considered his situation. He had kept moving throughout the day, wandering inconspicuously among crossing sweeps and dustmen, sandwich men wearing billboards front and back, shoeblacks, horseholders, piemen and pickpockets. He was weary to the bone, but he felt safer out in the streets than trapped in the confines of his flat. Crumbling the bit of parchment into a ball, Ethan dropped it over the bridge railing and watched it descend more than 40 feet until it hit the smeary black water. Despite ongoing efforts, stricter legislation, new sewer lines and pumping stations, to reduce the foul substances released into the Thames, the water's oxygen levels were too low to support fish or marine mammals. The little ball vanished slowly beneath the opaque surface. Ethan's gaze lifted to the dome of St. Paul's, the tallest structure in London. Beyond it, a ragged veil of clouds glowed with milky luminescence, flashes of pink and orange piercing through a few places like veins pulsing with light. He thought of Garrett, as he always did during quiet moments. At this time of day, she was usually at home. Not far from here, slightly less than 3 miles. Some part of his brain was always calculating her probable location, the distance between them. The thought of her soothed and pleasured him, made him aware of his humanity as nothing else could. A thunderous sound heralded a train crossing along the railway between Blackfriars and Southwark Bridges. Although Ethan was well accustomed to railway noise, he flinched at the violent rattling of metal plate girders, ironwork rail supports, and rolling stock couplings. Continuous, ear-splitting puffs of steam were punctuated regularly by the combustive roar of the firebox. Turning from the water, Ethan began to resume his walk along the path. He was stunned by a tremendous wallop to his chest, as if someone had struck him with a cudgel. He was thrown backwards onto his arse, the breath knocked out of him. Wheezing and choking, he worked to pull air back into his lungs. A strange, buzzing feeling circled through his insides. It took all his strength to rise to his feet. His limbs weren't working properly, muscles quivering and bunching in response to the confused signals of his brain. The buzzing turned into something searing and terrible, hotter than fire. It didn't seem possible that human flesh could harbour so much pain. Unable to identify the cause, Ethan looked down at himself in bewilderment. A flooding dark stain spread over the front of his shirt. He'd been shot. His numb gaze lifted to behold William Gamble walking toward him, a short, gripped bulldog revolver in hand. The deafening roar of the train went on and on, while Ethan backed up to the bridge railing and leaned against it to keep from collapsing.
"Counting on Felbrigg's honour, were you?"
Gamble asked when the noise had faded.
"He's a bureaucrat at heart. He'll always defer to the next man up the chain. Tapham and Jenkin convinced him their plans were all for the greater good."
Ethan stared at him dumbly. Christ Jesus. The Commissioner of Police was going to allow scores of innocent people, including women and children, to be maimed and murdered, all for the sake of political advantage.
"Robin Tatum's safe on my watch, you bastard,"
Gamble was saying irritably.
"The only reason Jenkin hasn't put a bullet in my head is because he was the one who made a hash of it by inviting Dr. Gibson to the soiree in the first place."
He approached Ethan slowly.
"I didn't want to finish you off like this. I wanted it to be a fair fight."
"'Twas fair enough," Ethan managed to say. "Should have seen it coming." There was a salty, liquid rattle in his throat. He coughed and saw blood spatter on the ground. As he leaned over, he glanced through the stone balustrades at the expanse of dark water below. Lifting himself up, he braced heavily against the railing. There was no way to win. No path to survival.
"You should have," Gamble agreed. "But you've been distracted for weeks, thinking of nothing but that green-eyed bitch. She's brought you to this."
Garrett. She wouldn't know he'd been thinking of her at the last moment. She would never know what she'd meant to him. It would make dying so much easier if only he'd told her. But she would do well without him, just as she had before. She was a strong, resilient woman, a force of nature. He only worried that no one would bring her flowers. How strange that as his life was spinning down to its end, there was no anger or fear, only soul-scorching love. He was dissolving in it. There was nothing left but the way she'd made him feel.
"Was she worth it?" Gamble jeered.
Gripping the railing behind him, Ethan smiled faintly.
"Aye."
In the next moment, he tipped back and let the momentum bring his legs up, his body rolling into a backward flip before heading into the water, feet first. During the dizzying plummet, he was vaguely aware of more shots being fired. Holding his breath, he braced for the impact. The world exploded into foul, freezing blackness, like hell after all the fire and brimstone had been extinguished. Liquid death. He struggled feebly, unable to see or breathe. Finally, he had reached the level of damage his body could not endure. He was pulled downward into a cold, insistent silence, where there was no time, no light, no self. He vanished beneath the great river and the city of millions and its inscrutable sky, his body nothing but mites and motes of fleeting mortality. The throbs of his failing heart echoed the rhythm of one name. Garrett. Garrett. She was somewhere. Not far. He clung to that thought as he was pulled by the ancient current to his fate. Chapter 15.
"Eliza," Garrett said wearily, rubbing her eyes. "Just because my father wants something doesn't mean you have to give it to him."
The cookmaid faced her defensively as they stood in the kitchen, where the heavy, ripe sweetness of mincemeat pie hung thickly in the air.
"I gave him the thinnest sliver, no whiter than your finger. Look, I'll show the pie to you."
"I don't want to see the pie. I want you to follow the weekly menu I gave you. He can't abide eating like an invalid. He is an invalid. After working long hours at the clinic, Garrett had returned home to discover that Eliza had taken it upon herself to make one of her father's favourite dishes, an enormous mincemeat pie that was too heavy and rich for his sensitive digestive system. It was also frightfully expensive, made with 6 pounds of currants and raisins, 3 pounds of apples, 3 pounds of suet, 2 pounds of sugar, 2 pounds of beef, a pint each of wine and brandy, and a variety of spices, all loaded into a flour crust and baked into a dark, sticky mass. There was no sound from her father's room upstairs. Eliza had already carried a slice up to him, and he was undoubtedly gorging on it as fast as possible. "In an hour or two he'll be complaining of stomach pains," Garrett said. "Mincemeat pie is made with everything that's bad for him, from suet to sugar." Half defiant, half apologetic, Eliza retorted, "Mr. Gibson used to eat it every Sunday. Now he's never allowed a single bite. What pleasures has he got left? No wife, no sweets, can't hardly walk, eyes too poor for reading. Just sits in his room and counts the days until his next game of draw poker. I say let him have a midge of joy now and then." An impatient reply hovered on Garrett's lips, but she bit it back as she considered Eliza's words. The cookmaid had a point. Stanley Gibson, once a vigorous and active man, a constable with a London beat, now spent most of his days in a quiet room. A cheerful, comfortable room, but even so there must be times when it felt like a prison. What harm would it do to allow him a little indulgence now and then? In Garrett's concern over doing everything she could to preserve what remained of his physical health, she mustn't deny him the small enjoyments that made life tolerable. "You're right," she said, reluctantly. Eliza's mouth sagged open. "I am? I agree that everyone deserves a midge of joy now and then." "It's right fair-minded of you to say so, Doctor. However, if this particular midge keeps him up half the night with a bellyache, you're going to help me with him." The cookmaid's lax mouth stretched into a satisfied grin. "Yes, Doctor." After going upstairs to visit her father, who had looked vastly pleased with himself and stoutly insisted the mincemeat pie would cause him no troubles whatsoever, Garrett went down to the front receiving room. She sat at the escritoire desk and sorted through correspondence and picked at the slice of mincemeat pie Eliza had brought her. She could only manage a bite or two. She'd never been fond of sweet and savoury dishes, and she certainly never shared her father's fondness for this one. In her opinion, mincemeat pie was a jumble of ingredients that had never been meant to unite in one crust. It was a heavy, overpowering dish, entirely resistant to digestive enzymes. Even before the pie, her stomach had felt unsettled. She had worried all day, knowing that by now Ethan had taken the incriminating information to Scotland Yard. The machinery of justice had been set in motion, and both Lord Tatham and Sir Jasper would surely be on the defensive, trying to save their own necks. She reassured herself with the thought that Ethan was familiar with every inch of London, and he was as sharp and sure-footed as any man alive. He could take care of himself. In a few days, when the conspirators were safely behind bars, Ethan would call on her. It cheered Garrett to think about him at her doorstep, big and handsome, perhaps a bit nervous as she invited him inside. They would discuss the future, their future, and she would convince him that despite his concerns, they would be happier together than apart. And if Ethan couldn't bring himself to propose to her, Garrett would simply have to do it herself. How did one go about proposing marriage? In the novels, a couple emerged after a moonlight stroll with the engagement as a fait accompli, leaving the reader to imagine the scene. Garrett had heard that the suitor went down on one knee, which he certainly wasn't going to do for anyone, unless you were helping to load him onto an ambulance stretcher. Since lilting romantic phrases were hardly Garrett's forte, it really would be better if Ethan were the one to propose. He would say something lovely and poetic in that beguiling Irish accent. Yes, she would find a way to make him do it. Was she really considering marriage to a man she knew so little? Had another woman been in this situation, Garrett would have advised her to wait and find out more about the prospective husband. There were more ways for it to go all wrong than there were ways for it to go right. "But I've had to wait for so many things in my life," she thought. She spent years studying and working while other young women were being courted. Becoming a doctor had been her dream and her calling. She had never trusted that in the future she would find a stable and loving partner who would take care of her. She hadn't wanted to depend on someone out of necessity. Garrett had no regrets. This was the life she had wanted. At the same time, she was tired of being cautious and responsible. She yearned to fling herself headlong into the experience of being loved, desired, possessing and possessed. And Ethan Ransom was the only man who'd ever made her want to take the risk of true intimacy, not only physically but also emotionally. It would be safe to allow him inside her most private thoughts and feelings. He would never mock or hurt her, or take more than he gave. At the same time, he would be a demanding lover. He wouldn't let her hide or withhold anything. And that was as frightening as it was exciting. A sharp rapping of the lion's head knocker jarred Garrett from her reflections. It was well past calling or delivery hours. Before 5 seconds had passed, another burst of percussion resounded through the air. Eliza sped to the entranceway, exclaiming beneath her breath about people knocking fit to wake the dead. "Evening," Garrett heard the cookmaid say. "What business are you about?" A muffled conversation ensued. Unable to make out what was being said, Garrett frowned and half turned in her chair to look at the sitting room doorway. Eliza came into view, holding a folded card. She frowned and chewed at her lips before saying, "It's one of Lord Trinneer's footmen, Doctor. He bid me to give you this while he waits." Garrett extended her hand for the note. Breaking the wax seal, she saw a few lines written in a hasty forward slant, the T's crossed to the right of the stems, the dot of one of the I's missing. It was from Kathleen, Lady Trinneer, the Earl's wife. "Dr. Gibson, if you are able, I beg you to come to Ravenel House with all possible haste. There has been an accident involving a guest. As the matter is sensitive, I ask your discretion in keeping this matter entirely private. Thank you, my friend. K." Garrett stood up so abruptly that her chair nearly toppled backward. "Someone's been injured," she said. "I'm off to Ravenel House. Make certain the surgical kit is in my bag and fetch my coat and hat." Eliza, bless her, wasted no time with questions and scampered off. She had helped Garrett on many occasions when speed was of the essence in seeing to a patient. Although Garrett was Lady Helen's doctor as well as Pandora's, the rest of the Ravenels usually relied on the services of a trusted family physician. Why hadn't they sent for him? Was he unavailable, or had they decided Garrett was better equipped to deal with the situation? The footman, a tall, fair-haired fellow, obeyed instantly as she gestured for him to follow her to the surgery. "Who's been injured?" Garrett asked briskly.
"Afraid I don't know, miss. Ma'am. Doctor. A stranger."
"Male or female?"
"Male."
"What happened to him?" At his hesitation, Garrett said impatiently, "I must know the nature of the injury so I can bring the right supplies."
"It was an accident with a firearm."
"Right," she said briskly, snatching up a wire basket filled with odds and ends, and dumped it out on the floor. Hurrying to a supply shelf, she began selecting bottles and putting them in the basket. Chloroform, ether, carbolic acid, iodoform, collodion, bismuth solution, cotton lint, gauze, rolled bandages, glycerin, catgut ligatures, isopropyl alcohol, metallic salts. "Carry this," she said, shoving the basket at the footman, "and this." She hefted a large jug of sterilized water and gave it to him. He curved his free arm around it, staggering slightly. "Come," she said, striding to the entranceway, where Eliza was waiting with her hat and walking coat. "I don't know how long I'll be away," Garrett said to the cookmaid, tugging on her coat. "If my father complains about his stomach, give him a dose of the digestive tonic in his bedroom cabinet." "Yes, doctor." Eliza handed her the heavy leather doctor's bag and cane. The footman hurried to the front door and struggled to open it with both arms full, until Eliza darted forward to do it for him. Garrett stopped at the threshold as she saw the plain black carriage with no identifiable insignias or designs. Glancing at the footman suspiciously, she asked, "Why is it unmarked? The Ravenel carriage has the family crest lacquered on the side."
"It was Lord Trinneer's decision. It is a private matter, he told me."
Garrett didn't move.
What are the names of the family dogs?
The footman looked slightly affronted.
Napoleon and Josephine. Little black spaniels.
Tell me one of Lady Pandora's words. Pandora, one of the twins, often used made-up words such as frustrating or flopulous when the ordinary ones didn't suit her. Despite her attempts to curb the habit, they still slipped out from time to time. The footman thought for a moment.
Lamnesia, he ventured, as if hoping that would satisfy her. She said it when Lady Trinia misplaced her basket of wool knitting yarn.
That sounded like Pandora. Garrett gave him a decisive nod.
Let's proceed.
The drive from King's Cross to Ravenel House on South Audley was approximately 3.5 miles, but it felt like 300. Garrett simmered with impatience as she held her doctor's bag on her lap and kept a hand on the basket of rattling, sloshing bottles beside her. She was eager to do whatever she could for the Ravenels, who had always been gracious and kind, and had never put on airs despite their elevated social status. The current Earl Devon, Lord Trinia, was a distant Ravenel cousin, who had inherited the title unexpectedly after the last two earls had died in quick succession. Although Devon was a young man with no experience at running a large estate and managing its attendant financial obligations, he had shouldered the burden admirably. He had also taken responsibility for the three Ravenel sisters, Helen, Pandora, and Cassandra, all unmarried at the time, when he could have easily thrown them to the wolves. At last, the stately Jacobean house came into view, its squared-off shape ornamented with lavish scrolls, pilasters, arches, and parapets. For all its great size, the residence was welcoming and warm, comfortably mellowed with age. As soon as the carriage stopped, one footman was there to open the door while another reached in to assist Garrett.
"Take this,"
Garrett said without preamble, handing the basket of supplies to him.
"Be careful. Most of these chemicals are caustic and highly flammable."
The footman shot her a glance of suppressed alarm and gripped the basket carefully. Garrett alighted from the carriage by herself and strode across the flagstone tiles to the front steps of the house, almost running in her haste. Two women waited for her at the threshold. The plump, silver-haired housekeeper, Mrs. Abbott, and Lady Cassandra, a fair-haired young woman with blue eyes and the kind of face that belonged on a cameo. Behind them, the grand entrance hall bustled with a sense of controlled panic, housemaids and footmen running back and forth with cans of water and what appeared to be dirty toweling and linens. Garrett's nose twitched as she caught an ambient scent in the air. A taint of some kind of organic matter mixed with caustic chemicals. Whatever its source, the smell was rank and rotten. The housekeeper helped Garrett remove her hat and coat.
"Dr. Gibson," Cassandra said, her pretty features drawn and anxious. "Thank goodness you arrived so quickly."
"Tell me what happened."
"I'm not altogether sure. A man was brought here earlier by the river police, only they asked us not to tell anyone about it. He was thrown into the river, and they said, when they pulled him out, they thought he was dead. But then he started coughing and groaning. They brought him here because he was carrying one of Cousin West's calling cards in his wallet, and they didn't know where else to take him."
"Poor fellow," Garrett said quietly. Even a healthy man who'd been exposed to the toxic waters of the Thames would become seriously ill from it. "Where is he now?"
"They carried him into the double library,"
Mrs. Abbott said, gesturing toward a nearby hallway.
"It's a dreadful mess in there. Lord and Lady Trinia have been trying to wash the filth from him and make him more comfortable."
She shook her head and fretted. "The carpets, the furniture.
No doubt all ruined."
"Why would an Earl and Countess personally tend to a stranger?" Garrett asked, puzzled. A new voice joined the conversation as a man approached them from the hallway.
"He's not a stranger."
His voice was deep and easy, the accent refined. As Garrett turned to face him, a shock of excitement and confusion stopped her breath. "Ethan! Blue, blue eyes. The dark hair, the big athletic frame. But it was not him." A leaden weight of disappointment settled over her, followed by a chill of premonition.
"I'm West Ravenel."
The man glanced beyond her to Cassandra.
"Darling," he murmured, "let me have a few moments with the doctor."
The girl left at once, accompanied by the housekeeper. Turning back to Garrett, Ravenel said quietly, "The wounded man is an acquaintance of yours. You're here because he asked for you. Cold barbs of fear lodged in Garrett's chest. The few bites of mincemeat she'd